Hi, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome once again to Women's Voices. My guest this evening is producer-director Lisa Fruchtman, who with her brother Rob filmed and directed Sweet Dreams, a feature film being shown at the Mendocino Film Festival on June 2nd. Lisa is an Academy Award-winning editor who has worked in both feature film and television. Among her many film projects are Apocalypse Now, The Right Stuff, Children of a Lesser God, The Godfather Part 3, The Doctor, My Best Friend's Wedding, Dance With Me, and The Woodsman. For television, she has edited such HBO films as Truman, Witness Protection, Point of Origin, and Normal. Her awards and honors include an Oscar for The Right Stuff, Academy Award and BAFTA nominations for Best Editing for both Godfather Part 3 and Apocalypse Now, an Emmy nomination and a Cable Ace Award for Truman. The film, Sweet Dreams, follows a remarkable group of Rwandan women as they emerge from the devastation of the 1994 genocide, where almost a million minority Tutsis were killed by Hutus in 100 days, many by those they knew as friends and neighbors. And I might add, while our own government stood idly by and watched. In 2005, Kiki Kaitis, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly or not, Rwandan playwright, founded the first women's drum troupe in Rwanda, breaking the taboo against women drumming, bringing together women from both sides of the conflict, and opening Rwanda's first ice cream store to create a future of hope and possibility for themselves. Sister and brother filmmakers Lisa and Rob Fruchtman co-produced and directed this inspiring film to tell their story. Sweet Dreams has been screened at the United Nations and in film festivals around the world, and will be screened at the Mendocino Film Festival the weekend of May 31st through June 2nd, and it will be seen on June 2nd, and Lisa will be here for the screening. For the full schedule of world-class films and visiting filmmakers, go to mendocinofilmfestival.org. And now for a little music from my CD, Okwaka Speaks, The Words and Music of Mother God. The song, There's Going to Be a Wedding.
Above, proclaiming the wedding, where there's just nothing else but love. Oh, I'm going to wear my new dress, flowers in my hair, and I'll put my dancing shoes on, 'cause you're gonna be there. And my heart is overflowing, anticipating the scene of you and me together, at last completing the dream. Oh, I think we've come the long road to be here in this place where the love is all around us. with the light brightly shining from the heavens above, proclaiming the wedding where there's just nothing else but love. Dee dee dee. Just wait and see. Yes, there's gonna be a wedding of you and me, with the light brightly shining from the heavens above, proclaiming the wedding where there's just nothing else but love. In my hair, and I'll put my dancing shoes on, 'cause you're gonna be there. And my heart is overflowing, anticipating the scene of you and me together, at last completing the dream. Oh, I think we've come the long road to be here in this place, with the love all around us, and we're in a state of grace. With the light brightly shining from the heavens above, proclaiming the wedding where there's just nothing else but love.
Welcome, Lisa, to Women's Voices.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here. That was a beautiful song.
Well, thank you. It seemed a happy one, and this film is so beautifully happy. My first question is, what part did your mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Well, I don't know exactly, but, you know, I'm a pretty independent woman. I've had a career and a family and children. And my mother, you know, has been a great role model for me in that way, although she came to that herself through harder circumstances. My dad died when she was 39 and the mother of three young children. And so she really had to go out and develop a career for herself and raise us by herself for the most part. And, you know, that took a lot of strength. And you know, at the end of the day, though, I think I was given a model of independence and power that, you know, I've carried with me. I've always felt that I could do whatever I made up my mind to do. And I always imagined myself with a career, with work, with the ability to support myself, the need to be able to support myself, and to have a family at the same time. And that's what I've done.
Well, that's wonderful. It must have been terribly hard for her. How old were you all when she lost her husband?
Yeah, well, I was 8 and a half, going on 9. My brothers were younger, 7 and 5. So
wow.
It was a dramatically difficult situation. You know, not at all what one wishes for anybody. But
right. And finding childcare and all of that.
Everything.
Yes.
Yeah. And developing a career, because she hadn't necessarily planned on having one. She became a science writer, actually, in New York. So that was pretty amazing.
Well, it is amazing. Did you have other relatives around? Or?
Yeah, we actually moved from Chicago in New York, from Chicago to New York, when my father died, so that my mother could be near her three brothers. So I had three very loving uncles around me growing up, as well as a lot of amazing family friends. So yes, we had a lot of support growing up. And later on, you know, my mother worked and supported us and raised us. And then later on, she remarried, and she was able to explore and develop herself in ways that she couldn't while she was, you know, had all the stress of family raising and working. And she actually had her own radio show on public radio called Health News and Views. And it was an interview show much like this one. But she was interviewing people in the health field.
How interesting.
About their work.
Yes. Yeah. Is she still doing it?
No, she isn't. She's 95 and going strong, but not on the radio.
Uh-huh. How wonderful. Uh-huh. Well, she certainly is a role model, and what a great woman. How old are your children?
My children are 24 and 28 and a half, and my daughter is in med school on her way to becoming a doctor, and my son is interested in art and architecture and doing that work in New York at the moment, the kind of think tank, so they're doing well.
Yes, and what role models they have around them with their mother and uncle.
And they have a great father. He's a psychiatrist, my husband. Uh-huh. So I haven't had to do anything alone like my mother did.
You're one of the lucky ones.
I am.
Yeah. How did you come into film? I mean, you were in New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, I came into film in a kind of odd way. I was at university, and I wasn't interested in film. I actually majored in history and philosophy of science. But I was interested in politics, and I did a lot of political work. And along the way, I met some wonderful filmmakers who are still around today, but they were the first true film cooperative, I guess, in the United States. Their name is Cartemquin Films, and they made social activist films starting in the early 70s and continuing on till today. They produced the movie Hoop Dreams. They've made a lot of wonderful films. And at the time I met them, I didn't know that I was really interested in film, but I knew that I was interested in politics. And then after I graduated college, I wasn't quite ready to go to graduate school, hadn't decided whether I was going to do law or science or what I was going to do. And I traveled around for a year around the world by myself. When I came back, I apprenticed myself to this group of documentary filmmakers. I didn't see it as a permanent thing. I saw it as a way to do political work for a while I decided what I was going to do with my career. But I worked with them, and then I moved to Montreal, and I was lucky enough to get a job at the National Film Board of Canada. And again, I worked in documentaries, and again, I didn't think it was a real career decision. It was just something I was interested in and pursuing and learning from while I was trying to decide. And then I moved to San Francisco, and I couldn't find work in documentaries, but I did find work in feature films, and I worked as an assistant on Godfather Part II with Francis Coppola. And then I became very smitten with feature films, and I went and I did that for the next 25 years. And now I've returned to my roots. I've had a wonderful career working on very big, wonderful, important films. But then I decided I wanted to make this film, which was very close to the state of mind I was in when I first started with Cartemquin back in the 70s. And I asked my brother, who is a documentary filmmaker in New York, if he wanted to do it with me. And I thought that we kind of brought two different perspectives to the project and different talents, and that together we would make a good film. And I hope we have. It's been a great experience.
So it's a wonderful film. So did you go to, obviously you must have gone to film school someplace in there.
No, I didn't go to film school. I did it as an apprenticeship. In other words,
I started
out as an apprentice, and you know, my first real job at the film board was as an assistant, and then I was an apprentice and an assistant on Godfather II. But I was able to move because of the times and good luck and the generosity of people like Francis Coppola and others, I was able to move very, very quickly through the ranks. So I was a first assistant on Apocalypse Now, but by the end of Apocalypse Now, I was an editor. And that was because it was a 2.5-year project. And so that's how I learned to become a filmmaker.
Well, that sounds very exciting. I envy you. How then did you come across the story of Kiki and the work she was doing?
Well, that was another kind of amazing just coincidence. I have, for many summers, served as an advisor at the Feature Film Lab of the Sundance Institute, which is in Utah. It's a kind of incubator program, a lab that Robert Redford established. There's a theater lab, a dance lab, a composer's lab, and a feature film lab where filmmakers are selected to develop their work and to bring work, bring scenes, work on them in a workshop environment. And mentors and advisors are brought in. So I was an advisor at the Feature Film Lab in 2009, and I heard a story of an amazing thing that had happened at the theater lab, which is that a Rwandan theater director had come with a play, and she had met an actor there who was also an ice cream entrepreneur, and together they had decided to work on opening an ice cream shop in Rwanda. That was all I heard at the beginning. But that's how I heard about Kiki Katesi, who is a really remarkable, remarkable Rwandan visionary. She's a playwright and a poet and a director, and she is the one that had the idea in 2005. The genocide was over in 1995. In 2005, she launched an initiative to bring women together from both sides of the conflict, and to bring them together to drum, which was not an avenue open to women previously. And there was dance for women, traditional dance, but not drumming. So she invited women to come from the villages, from both sides, into a kind of drumming circle, which broke the taboo against women drumming.
I'm surprised that the men didn't object.
Well, as she recounts in the film in a really delightful way, she said she went to the National Museum to find out what this taboo was all about. And what they told her was, well, it wasn't actually forbidden, it just wasn't done. You know, drumming had been traditionally the province of men, particularly men who drummed for the king, and then later men in other ways. And really, you know, women had better things to do, and maybe they weren't strong enough anyway, the people at the museum said. And she said, well, let's just see. Let's see how strong we are. And so it wasn't forbidden exactly, but there was a lot of skepticism about it. And in fact, they were made fun of by men. But gradually, that idea that changed. And the men became very proud of these women and became proud of, you know, the new things that were happening in Rwanda, the way in which Rwanda was changing after the genocide, and this being one of them. So it changed from skepticism to pride. But we do show in the film, you know, people peering in, people, particularly men, peering in as the women rehearse. It's something new for many of them, and they can't quite decide how they feel about it. So this turned out, the development of the drumming troupe just turned out to be an incredibly healing and empowering initiative. It brought women together from both sides in a country that is just filled with pain and trauma. And it gave women, village women who were really mostly subsistence farmers, gave them tremendous confidence and power, a sense of power of something new that they could do and something they were being recognized for. So the drum troupe became a very healing and empowering place to be. And close to 100 women have drummed together for a number of years. And out of that 100 women, 25 to 30 became really fantastic drummers, enough to be able to be a performing troupe and to begin to perform at events in Rwanda and ultimately to be invited outside of Rwanda to Senegal and ultimately France and the Netherlands. Meanwhile, Kiki met Jenny Dundas, the actor, at Sundance in 2008, and that's when she got the idea to have Jenny and her partner, Alexis, from Blue Marble Ice Cream in Brooklyn, New York, helped the drumming troupe opened the first ice cream shop in Rwanda. And as disparate as these ideas sound, drumming and ice cream, they're actually quite related. At least they were in Kiki's mind. They were new. They were empowering, in this case, financially empowering, and they were joyful. And I think that this was something she really wanted to bring into a country that is still full of trauma. I'd like to quote from her. She says a quote that we often use in things we write about the film. She says, "In a country full of pain and grief, I chose to bring life. I chose to bring joy." So that's what she did. Mm-hmm. And we entered the project at the very beginning of the Ice Cream Initiative. So that was happening in early 2009. And as soon as I heard this story, I just knew that I wanted to make a film about it. And I felt that these elements, the drumming and the ice cream, even though I hadn't met any of the women yet, or even Kiki, or even Jenny and Alexis, I felt these were an amazing set of elements that were coming together, a very unique set of elements. And it goes from there. So my brother and I agreed to make the film, but we had to move very, very quickly because the Ice Cream Initiative was beginning. And so we basically got on a plane in January 2010 and went to Rwanda with our camera and another cinematographer. And we really didn't know what we would find there. We didn't know. We hadn't met Kiki yet or the women or ever been to Rwanda. And it was really jumping in feet first and learning a lot very fast about the country and beginning the project that way.
It must have been beautiful, too.
Rwanda is a very beautiful country, very beautiful. And that is something that people comment on in the film. There's a lot of beauty in the film, both the beauty of the country, the beauty of the people, the beauty of the drumming. There's a lot of sadness in the film because we do, of course, go into the genocide and the stories of the women. But there's a lot of beauty, a lot of joy, and a lot of humor. And I think people are surprised by that.
As I was watching it, I was trying to think, how do you film this? For instance, the business around the ice cream machine and getting the machine to work. And I was thinking, are you filming this? Do you know whether it's going to work or not? Or
Oh, no, of course not.
So you were right in the middle of it.
Yes. I mean, this is a verite documentary, which means we are filming life as it is unfolding in front of us. We're not controlling anything. Nothing is scripted. Nothing is organized. We've just placed ourselves in the middle of this life. And, you know, along the way, we are getting to know certain women better and better, and we are doing interviews with them, which are more intimate. But for the scenes in which we're with the group, whether they're drumming or rehearsing or in the ice cream shop or in the things that, not to give away too much, we hope listeners will be coming to the film to see what happens. But there's some tension and there's some suspense and there's some questions about whether the whole initiative will work, and all of that is just unfolding as we are there. We filmed over the course of a year and a half. We didn't live in Rwanda for the whole year and a half. We did four shoots of roughly 5 to 6 weeks each time. So we've spent 5.5 or so months in Rwanda, all told, over the course of a year and a half. And, you know, different parts that you see in the film happened at different times. And we had the challenge in editing of drawing it all together into a coherent whole.
Temperature-wise, was it hard to get used to? Was it extremely hot?
Not really. You know, Rwanda is actually quite temperate, and because it's up in the mountains. There were some times when it was very, very hot, and there was times when it was raining and times when it was cold. So temperature was not an issue. The things you think are going to be the issues are not the issues. It was actually, we got quite used to filming and living in very bare circumstances. We didn't find that difficult. What was difficult was sorting out the emotional landscape of the country, which is very, very mixed. There's tremendous progress happening in Rwanda. And there's tremendous trauma still in Rwanda. It was only 17 years after the genocide when we began filming. And so everyone you meet, really, in unless except for small children, has been affected profoundly in one way or another. They are either survivors, victims, or relatives of perpetrators. Everybody carries a very heavy load. And so figuring out how to interact with that, as well as the language barrier. You know, we had interpreters, wonderful interpreters, that we found. And as we did the interviews, we were getting to know people better and better. But often when we were just filming in a verite situation, nothing was being translated for us, and so we didn't actually know what was being said. We found out a lot later what was being said. We had an intuition about what was happening, but not an exact knowledge of what was happening. We just had to really tune ourselves into these women.
The intimate ones that you spoke with, they took you to their home, and you saw how they lived, and the hardship of all of that. And
yes, and that took a long time to build that trust. You know, we began our first shoot with, we were very lucky when we arrived. Kiki was holding a conference called Culture and Conflict, and the drummers were going to perform at it. So luckily for us, the day we arrived, they were already rehearsing outside, 100 women. We were able to begin filming the drumming right away. Because we didn't know when we got on the plane how we were going to get them drumming for us, but we were just very lucky in that respect. But getting to know them personally over time was the important thing. And of course, following the ice cream project through all of its ups and downs, and it had both, and we had no idea how it would all shake out.
The women are so beautiful. These women, with their dark skin, with their golden skin, really, and beautiful, shining teeth, and wonderful energy, and amazing energy, and drumming. I mean, it's very exciting.
It is exciting. It's exciting for them, and therefore it's exciting for us to watch it, because you can see how transformative it has been for them. And it certainly has been transformative for them on a very personal, deep, emotional level. But they're also getting some recognition, and they're getting even more recognition through the film, which we're so excited about for them. In fact, Kiki and the women received a really important honor. Last November, the Common Ground Award, which is given by a big worldwide NGO called Search for Common Ground, for people that have made important contributions in peace and reconciliation. And this award has been given to people like Desmond Tutu, Jimmy Carter, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's the president of Liberia, many people like that. And here we have Kiki and drummers getting this award. So that was very, very exciting. We've shown the film at the UN and continue to travel with certain UN programs with the film. So the women are getting known, and hopefully more and more they will be known, and they will be invited as performers. And also we hope through the film, and we want to encourage people who are hearing this show and who come to see the film, to get involved with supporting this initiative in Rwanda, because it's really something important that they're doing, and something they still need support with. It's difficult. So we're happy that they're getting visibility and recognition.
Does the troupe change?
It does change, and it is open to new people. Like I said, there are a lot of people who began drumming together, and some people naturally are gifted and some people less so. And for some, it is just a wonderful place to come together with a group of women in a healing way and a building of community and new friendships. And for others, it's become a real art form. And Kiki is a very tough taskmaster. She really insists on a rigorous discipline of rehearsal time. So those that have really been able to commit to that are really the ones that travel to perform, because they're the best. Whereas in other sort of circumstances, all 100 or 65 might drum together. But for a trip to the U.S. or a trip to France or a trip to another country in Africa, the group will be selected from those that have worked the hardest and are really committed. But it changes. You know, we were able to have a group of women who happened to be the main, three of them, the main characters in our film, come to the film festival in New York and in Amsterdam. We received foundation support to bring them, which was fantastic. And then recently, they were Kiki and some women were invited to play at the Skull World Forum on Social Entrepreneurship in Oxford, England, which is a major sort of social change conference on the level of the Clinton Global Initiative. So they performed. So Kiki came, and she brought five different women than the women who had traveled with us because she wants to give more women a chance.
So yeah. How about the ice cream store? Does people change there as well?
Yes, people change there as well. As for those people that will be coming to see the film, we hope, in Mendocino, the building of the ice cream project had a lot of big, important issues to deal with. I mean, only a certain number of people could be employed in the shop, 10, actually. But it's owned by a cooperative of women, and the women had to join this cooperative and pay into this cooperative to join it. But a lot more women than were ultimately that were employed were trained. So a lot of women received training, business training, and training in English, and training in computers. The Blue Marble women were able to bring mentors like Business Council for Peace, which is a organization of businesswomen who go to places like Rwanda, El Salvador, and Afghanistan, training women in business skills. So a lot of the women, the drummers, received this training, even though only 10 got the initial jobs. And we show this in the film, that the women, some women are chosen and some women are not. It's turned over. It tends to turn over as people's lives move along. You know, somebody has a baby, and that means there's room for a different woman to come in. Several of the younger women have now gone to university, and so that's opened a few jobs for other women as well. So it does turn over in that way.
It must change their lives in enormous ways, their whole experience and exposure and, of course, feeling of self-confidence. That I'm wondering, do they still find men there that they are coupling with?
Well, this is a very women-dominated project. My poor brother was the only man around involved. Some of the women are in couples, they're in marriages, but most are not. But that is due to the situation in Rwanda. That is due to the number of men that were killed and the number of men that were in prison. There are also women who were killed and women who were in prison, but of course not in the same proportions. And it's true that the project has given these women tremendous confidence and has empowered some of them financially. I don't think that keeps men away. I think that the opposite is true. I think that they're empowered to help financially with their families, and this is a good thing. This is a good thing for men as well. So, you know, the absence of men is for a different reason.
There's such a contrast in the men that I saw kind of just hanging around. You know, she made such a point about people having gone through such horror are kind of dead inside.
Right. Well, that's right. That is one of her ideas, and one of the things that why we thought this was such an important film to make is that, you know, millions of dollars poured into Rwanda after the genocide, and so much good work has been done by NGOs around the world and is being done all over the world in ways that are very concrete and easy to understand. You know, people are working against AIDS, people are working for pure water, people are working in so many ways to bring good health care. But not too many people are addressing the issues of the spirit. And Kiki is really talking about something subtle and something inside, how the country can recover and how people can recover from within. And she's choosing this very unique way of doing that. It's, you know, there's not a culture of therapy, there's not time, there's not money. This is a different way of helping people move forward emotionally, which is crucial for healing the country. And so this idea of people that, as she said, are just bodies moving, but inside they're dead, is something that she is trying very hard to find ways to to address that. And she continues to find other ways. She has new projects as well. So the drumming troupe and the ice cream shop have very concrete benefits, financial benefits, artistic benefits, but they also have a much subtler and broader benefit. That's what the movie is trying to communicate, as well as the idea of dreaming, dreaming of new possibilities. I think that it's very important to understand that it wasn't just starting a business. Like, she could have started a basket weaving business or a jewelry making business or many of the traditional businesses that exist, or she could have started a dance troupe, which is the kind of thing that exists. But she started two things that never existed before. And that newness, that boldness in doing things that were unknown is a way to kind of kickstart the engine of change and to try other things that have never been done before and to learn to dream and to imagine a new kind of society.
Wow, what an amazing woman she is.
She is an amazing woman. She is an amazing woman. And she's able to talk about things think of things, because she is Rwandan, that, you know, if they came from a Westerner, they would maybe sound a bit strange. And when we first started working on the movie and talked about ice cream or drumming, people said, really? Is that what people really need in Rwanda? That sounds so trivial. But when people see the movie, they don't feel that way anymore.
Yeah. And they didn't even have ice cream before.
They didn't know what it was. There is some ice cream in the capital. These women had never tasted ice cream. There is some ice cream in the capital for expats and the wealthy, but it doesn't come from Rwanda. And most people have never tasted it. And these women had never tasted it, which we found to be a very poignant and amazing situation, that they were willing to go on this journey with Kiki to create something, but they weren't sure what it was.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? It is.
But they thought, well, she took us down a path before that was very amazing, so we're willing to try it again.
They were open.
They were open. And
that's exciting.
Nobody really knew whether it would work. You know, it's not an easy thing. It's still not easy. It's developing a new market. But it's important to say that this is not a Western idea. This was Kiki's idea. And Rwanda is a dairy-producing country, and people love milk. It's just that they don't have much refrigeration, and they just had never been exposed to ice cream.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how things are going in the refrigeration department.
That's something we'll announce at our screening, and I'll say it here on the air for anybody that's listening, is that one of our goals with the film and is that we are going to share. We are raising money as we go to distribute the film, and we share all money, and to support the women. We share all money with the women. We will be sharing all money that we get with the women. And one of our goals is to help them buy a generator, because the electricity goes out quite a bit. And when that happens, obviously, the ice cream melts, or they can't make ice cream, and they lose a lot of business. So if they can have their own generator, it will make a big difference. So we want to be helping them do that, and we want to encourage anybody who is inspired by the film to log on to our website. Can I say that right now?
Oh, please do.
Okay, our website is www.sweetdreamsrwanda.com. And on our website, you can see a trailer for the film. You can read about us as filmmakers. You can see some of our partners. And you can go to our donate page, and you can donate to the outreach campaign and to the women. And this will be helping them buy their generator.
That's
pretty
wonderful.
Soon.
And that address again is?
SweetDreamsRwanda.com.
You are listening to Lisa Fruchtman, who is producer-director of the film Sweet Dreams, which will be shown at the Mendocino Film Festival on June 2nd. And as I understand, we will be getting ice cream after the movie. Did you know that?
No, I didn't hear.
Yeah.
That's great.
I think that's great. It won't be
very appropriate.
Won't be Rwandan ice cream, but it will be our local ice cream.
Great.
The film, Sweet Dreams, it's beautiful. You'll love it. It's very heartwarming. The touching stories and the beautiful countryside and these amazing women and drumming. And the men are drumming as well.
But, oh, you gave away the ending.
Oh, dear. I won't say another word. They have their own particular way of drumming, robust, very vigorous.
Well, like I said, those original big standing drums that they play, those are Rwandan drums, and they were historically used to wake up the king and, you know, accompany the king when the king had his kingly business. So they are very, very powerful. The women do play not only Rwandan rhythms, but Burundian rhythms. They have had teachers come from Burundi, which is a very sophisticated drumming culture, actually, and from Senegal. And so they play some other rhythms as well. I mean, always on the Rwandan drums.
Yes, they are very intricate mm-hmm. rhythms. Another thing that you've mentioned that I wasn't aware of, and I'm not sure many people are, that they have a month of mourning once a year at the time of the genocide.
That's right. It's really, it's actually 100 days, but it's really mainly the month of April. The genocide started in April, and it's April 7th is the beginning of the commemorative period. And it's a very, very intense and traumatic time in the country, and it's so intense that we didn't even film the first year. We were there in April, but we didn't film the first year because we wanted to know women better, and we just could not figure out how we could film during that period. Mm-hmm. There are memorial sites all over the country, so there are lots and lots of sites where there are skulls and bones and bodies, whole skeletons, many, in various churches around the country. So we had filmed that, but we actually didn't know how we were going to integrate the genocide into our film. I mean, you cannot make a movie about Rwanda without referencing or discussing or showing something about the genocide, because it informs everything and everybody. But at the same time, there have been other films done about the genocide, and that wasn't the film we were making. What we ended up doing was filming in the month of April at the very end of our shooting period, so that's a year and a half in. And we have amazing footage in the film, and probably we're the first people to have filmed what we filmed, mm-hmm. because it's not usually filmed. And it's a very difficult and hard period.
Yes, and it's as if you are just, the watcher is just eyes there. I can't imagine how you were right in the middle of all of that, and it's, like, they just carried on.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, we were able to build up the trust of the people that we knew, but I think the scene that you're referring to was in the National Stadium.
Yes.
And we were completely terrified about filming that. And, of course, we had to have official permission and everything. We weren't really sure what we were going to be able to do, and we weren't really sure until we got home and looked at what we shot and put it together. We weren't sure what we had, which is turns out to be a very powerful scene. But it was hard. It was very, very hard.
And you must have had handheld cameras, so you were...
Yes. We benefited from the wonderful new technology of lightweight cameras, and we were able to, we weren't able to blend in because we're white and blonde.
Right.
So we definitely weren't blending in. But we were able to have a quiet presence. And my brother was shooting during that time, and he's very, very good at being, even though he's, 6'1" and blonde, he's very good at having a very quiet, unintrusive presence.
Mm-hmm.
And then in other scenes, we were very grateful for our young Rwandan interpreters who were survivors themselves. And so their sensitivity to the situation really helped us in terms of the way they handled the women in interviews and the way they were with us in all of these situations.
Mm-hmm. So they kind of had a sense of what you wanted and what you were going for.
Yeah, well, we would, obviously they were translating for us in both directions.
I see.
They were translating what I asked. I did a lot of the interviews. They translated what we were asking. Mm-hmm. My brother was shooting and I was often talking. They translated that, and then they translated back the answers, but not literally, because you couldn't stop every moment and translate. You had to kind of let it play out and then get a quick sense from them of where it was all going and then move on. So they were very, very, they had very delicate work to do, both with the women and with us, and they were amazing. It's important to say that the movie, in spite of having a lot of sadness in it, is overwhelmingly fun and also, you know, has a lot of lightness in it.
So. Oh, it does. You can't look at these women and not feel joy yourself. They are so joyful. Their smiles are stunning, I think is the word. You're still with this probably for a while.
I mean, we are with it for a while. I mean, we've been doing a lot of film festivals. We actually began, it's almost been a year, we began this public screening of the film in April at the United Nations in honor of the commemoration, which is just an incredible honor. And we showed the film to 400 people last April at the United Nations. And then we started our film festival runs. And we've been traveling with the film domestically and internationally. And that will continue, but it's winding down. And we're hoping to release the film theatrically in the fall. And also to launch our outreach and engagement campaign, which means a lot of community screenings, workshops for all kinds of groups. So we'll be launching that in the fall. We'll be working on that this summer, launching it in the fall, and really feel that the film can and does speak to so many different types of people, and we want to get it out to all of them. I have a nice quote I want to say, too. The film was shown at a woman's convocation in Romania through the Unitarian Church, actually.
Wow.
And it was shown to 500 women from 20 countries.
Mm.
No African countries, but, you know, many European countries and Eastern European countries. One of the responses we received was, I'll read it, "This was not only a film about women in Africa, it was a film about us, all of us. I saw what those women did, and I know in our own ways we will do that too. Thank you so much for bringing it to us." So we feel that, you know, the women, the film speaks to a lot of different women, a lot of different kinds of audiences, and we want to make sure it gets out to all of them.
Mm-hmm. It's so important.
We're hoping to bring Kiki back.
Oh, yes.
When we open the film. She is continuing to work not only with these women, but she has a new project, which is pretty exciting, called The Book of Life. And it is a collection of writings that she has collected over the course of several years in several workshops with survivors and with perpetrators and widows and kids. And they are letters from the living to the dead, and they're letters about life. They're letters about, somebody telling their mother that they just, their mother who's no longer with them, that they just graduated from high school, or they're getting married. The things that they would want these people to know, including perpetrators. And these are going to be dramatized during next April 2014, the 20th commemoration of the genocide. It's going to be a very positive memorial.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Lisa Fruchtman.
All right.
And we look forward to your film. I look forward to seeing you in person on June 2nd. And
wonderful.
Many blessings on your wonderful, wonderful work. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.